Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is Sunday Profile. Today, the Shadow Assistant Treasurer, Andrew Lee. The MP for Fraser, which covers Canberra's northern suburbs, is an unusual politician. For starters, he's an expert. He was Professor of Economics at the ANU before moving into politics. And as you'll hear, he'd begun another career before moving into economics. He also, much more than most of his contemporaries in Parliament, likes to think about ideas, and he's written four books to prove it. Andrew Lee has been an ALP member since he was a young man, but his interests in inequality and social justice go back further to an unusual childhood. So, with that focus on inequality, are we too generous when it comes to entitlements for politicians?
It's always going to be a difficult conversation about how we manage to make sure that politicians can do the work that the electorate expects, being in different parts of Australia, engaging with a range of issues right across a big and complicated country, but being frugal as we do so. I think it's reasonable that we have that conversation, but important too that we don't lose sight of the importance of politicians travelling. I want an Australian foreign minister who is engaged with people in other countries. I want a travelling foreign minister, not travelling for the sake of it, but travelling to take Australia's message to around the globe.
But most people aren't the foreign minister. This is about the issue that, I mean, of course, what's most in everyone's minds is the former Speaker Bronwyn Bishop and the issues of travel and entitlement that ultimately meant that she had to resign. And interestingly, just this week in The Drum, Jeff Sparrow's written that there is a widening gulf between politicians and ordinary people that can no longer be ignored.
I don't detect that widening gulf, but certainly it would be of deep concern to me if I saw it there. I spend a lot of time standing on street corners in my electorates, chatting to people who come into the office, responding to email and telephone calls. You try and be as responsive as you can in this job. Mine is the largest House of Representatives electorate in Australia with nearly 150,000 electors, and making sure that I'm fairly representing their views in the floor of Parliament is pretty vital, because this job is never a right, it's always a privilege.
I'll come back to your electorate in particular a bit later on, but I'm just keen to just keep moving through this part of it. How would you describe the media coverage of the parliamentary entitlements issue?
I think the media has appropriately focused on issues of breaching the rules, and I think they've also rightly raised the question as to where the boundaries are drawn. What the work that politicians do tends to be fairly complicated, and drawing clear boundaries is less straightforward than in other occupations. But we do need to make sure that people stick by the rules. Our concern with the former Speaker was a breach of the rules, which the former Speaker herself acknowledged.
Because you've written that that more aggressive media that covers politics like sport or gossip is largely responsible for the falling stocks of politicians.
I think it's one of the factors, Richard. Certainly what we've seen over the course of the last 15 years has been a whole lot more competition in the media market, largely driven by new technologies. All of those have, in some sense, driven an aggressive competition to be first with the headline, and that's sometimes comes at a cost of deeper analysis. It then changes the behaviour of politicians, who have a much stronger incentive than was the case 30 years ago to come up with a snappy line on a Parliament House doorstop. There's never been a better time to be a short-run populist, never been a harder time to be a long-game reformer. But all that means is that us long-game reformers need to work a bit harder.
Well, that surely is the leadership challenge, isn't it? How can you shift the attention of voters back to important issues like infrastructure, innovation, climate change?
There is a hunger for those deeper conversations. One of the things I love about holding town hall style meetings is that people say that they're sick of hearing about political issues in sound bites. They want to hear about them in paragraphs, not mere phrases.
Well, let's talk about a big issue, if only briefly, tax. So several economists have effectively said, look, We're going to have to pay more tax in order to deal with challenges like demographic change, rapidly increasing health costs. But neither side of politics will ever say we're going to have to pay more tax.
Richard, I've never thought of us as needing to target a particular size of government. On the facts, Australia's government is one of the smallest in the advanced world, much closer to the United States, Mexico and Korea than to the bigger spending governments of Scandinavia. All tiers of government account for about a third of the national economy compared to about a half in Scandinavian countries. But we always have to make sure that we're doing things as efficiently as we can, that we're spending taxpayers' dollars as efficiently as possible and raising the revenue that we need to. I think it was appropriate, for example, when we put in place the National Disability Insurance Scheme, that we then had an NDIS levy, because Australians want to know that if they fall off the roof and become a paraplegic, that they're in a country that doesn't expect them now just to have one shower a week.
I think that what you just said is heartfelt and true. But it didn't answer the actual question, which is why don't either side of politics talk about this when, you know, I could reel off the economists who've written, you know, we need to have a more mature conversation about tax. We are facing increasing costs and increasing challenges, and to pay for them, we're going to have to raise more revenue.
Well, Richard, I guess I'm pushing back on the notion that there is some perfect level of size of government and economy. I don't think that's right, because I think big spending governments and small spending governments can waste taxpayer dollars. So Labor's certainly put on the table a number of revenue-raising measures. We think that superannuation tax concessions aren't fair and aren't sustainable, and we've suggested a plan to rein them back. We've put on the table a plan to crack down on some of the loopholes we believe multinational firms are exploiting, and they'll increase the revenue take. But we've also said that Labor will be identifying savings as we go forth over between now and the election, because you can't just be looking at the tax side. You also have to be making sure that spending that isn't appropriate is curtailed.
This goes to the heart of something for you, because unlike the overwhelming majority of your fellow MPs, you're a genuine expert. You know, you a professor of economics before becoming a politician. Your currency in that realm was ideas. Now those ideas are constrained by political realities, though.
I don't see them as being constrained, Richard. I find it a terrific opportunity in the Parliament to be able to put economic analysis to work. I find thinking like an economist is incredibly powerful when you're confronting issues from climate change to defence policy to health policy to infrastructure. I approach pretty much every problem using cost-benefit analysis, thinking at the margin, ignoring sunk costs when I can. The sorts of ideas that we used to talk about on Right-Side Economics and Life Matters, those inform my thinking within the party, and they also inform the way in which I try and communicate. I'm increasingly finding myself, 5 years now in the job, much more reverting to type as an economist.
It's interesting because, as you mentioned, we've known each other a long time. I mean, you used to do a regular thing when I was on Life Matters, but I never got to ask you, why you've done this? Why go into politics?
It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to try and make a difference, Richard.
Let's just walk through it. You'd qualified as a lawyer. You clerked for a High Court judge, Justice Michael Kirby. Why not the law in the first instance?
So I moved away from the law to economics because I felt ultimately that while I loved the law, I learned more from Michael Kirby than from anyone else in the world apart from my parents, that ultimately the problems of poverty and inequality were better solved through the economic framework of incentives than through the legal framework of rights. So that then led me to go to the US and to retool as an economist and come back being able to apply that economic framework.
Yeah, so, okay, you do that, off to Harvard, back to Australia, full professor of economics in your mid-30s, 4 books about economics, no signs of being done on that yet. Why go from the relative purity of academia to the art of the possible, Andrew?
I guess, Richard, maybe it's useful to go a little bit back down the family tree. My father's father was a Methodist minister. My mother's parents were a boilermaker and a teacher who used to take refugees in the house. I was very much brought up with the notion that a life of service to others is a life well lived. And the opportunity to serve through through politics, to be able to make a difference in people's lives, to problems that your constituents bring you, but also to be able to have an impact through better policies in the long term, that's a chance to be jumped at.
Well, this is Sunday Profile. I'm Richard Odie. My guest today is the Federal Member for Fraser, which is the northern part of Canberra, and the Shadow Assistant Treasurer, Andrew Lee. Now, your childhood was an unusual one, wasn't it?
Yes, my father worked on AusAid-funded projects, both in Malaysia and then in Indonesia. I lived in Sarawak and Kuching for my second year, and then in Jakarta and Bandar Aceh in Indonesia from my fifth, sixth and seventh years. When I was in Bandar Aceh, I attended a local Indonesian school for a short period. Was the only white child in my class. It was a good experience for a kid who would otherwise have grown up as a comfortably white middle class environment in Australia, to be in a setting where people looked at you strangely for the colour of your skin, where occasionally I would be walking down the main street with my friend Nico, and some of the bigger boys would try and throw rocks at me because I looked a bit different. That experience of knowing what it's like to be an insider, a tiny little window into what so many minority Australians experience every day, was probably useful in framing how I think about the world.
So it was a formative thing to be the white kid and in surroundings where there was real poverty.
Absolutely. Many of my classmates went home to eat their dinner off banana leaves using their right hand. Always your right hand, because your left hand was used to wipe your bottom, because this is a culture with, you know, obviously no toilet paper, no running water in many of these homes.
And how did you find this out, Andrew?
I found this out the hard way when I was at Nico's house and needed to go to the toilet and discovered that their house had no toilet paper. So underneath the door were sent little torn up magazine pieces in order for me to deal with the call of nature. Was that the question you were asking, or did I just supply a little too much information?
I kind of wondered because you were talking about it, and I thought, hello.
Yes. I obviously spoke Indonesian with Nico and very much valued his friendship. We've stayed in touch. He joined the Indonesian army and also has a couple of little boys, as I do. So his generosity to me in exploring the town was important, but also that sense that there are people in the world who experience grinding poverty not through any moral failing of their own, not because they don't work hard enough, but simply because of the luck of the circumstances into which they're born, and that it's the obligation on those of us who've been fortunate to try and improve those circumstances.
So when you're back in Australia and you've grown up a bit more, and you've already mentioned your grandparents, and I think one grandparent was a Methodist minister, the other one was a lay preacher, so you've got a bit of Methodism going on there, if I could put it that way. Has religion had an impact then on your life, Andrew?
It has. Certainly, the way in which my grandparents thought, their willingness to open their own home to people they barely knew was extraordinary. So you'd go there and sitting around the table would be refugees, sometimes from Chile, sometimes from Cambodia, sometimes from Myanmar, people who then would tell their stories and also remind me of the extraordinary generosity of my grandparents in saying, well, there's a spare room in the home, someone ought to be using it. I'm doing a run at the end of this year in honour of my late grandfather Keith Lee. He died in 1970 running up Mount Wellington in the middle of Hobart to raise money for overseas aid. On the 45th anniversary of his passing, a group of us are joining the Point to Pinnacle run, which starts at Rest Point Casino and goes to the top of Mount Wellington, and we'll be raising money for World Vision. And it's been lovely through that, as the run has garnered some publicity, to then come into contact with people who knew Keith, who tell the stories of his passion for social justice and also his passion for running, which I share.
So that social justice thing has been front and centre for as long as you can remember. But I'm wondering about the religion, because I don't think you're a religious man.
Not as my grandfather was, but certainly the guiding principles that we're not put on the planet in order to solve all the problems, but that we have an obligation to make a difference while we're here. That very much animates how I think about the world. I enjoy, in particular, the company of many of the religious leaders in my electorate. I took my eldest son along to a Sikh temple the other day, and the genuine welcome that's provided in each of those environments, the strong sense of community, the embrace of children, the sheer joy when a child cries out during a service. Nothing that children do in religious services is considered inappropriate, and that celebrating and sense of community is something that all of us need to learn from.
Actually, your own economic research has shown the value of being religious in a way, hasn't it?
Indeed. I was very much guided by Robert Putnam, with whom I worked while I was at Harvard, in his book Bowling Alone. So when I came to write Disconnected for Australia, couldn't help noticing that churchgoers are more likely to give money, even when you exclude the money they give to the church, more likely to give their time, even when you exclude religious volunteering. Churchgoers are more likely, for example, to give blood. And part of that is that being part of a religious community gives you lots of opportunities where people ask you to help. And the best predictor as to whether somebody helps out and joins a community organisation is, did someone else ask them?
So you've already mentioned, and your MP for Fraser, and it is the most populous of the electorates, which means a heavy workload, I imagine. You're also an opposition frontbencher, which means lots of responsibilities, not a lot of resources compared to your opposite numbers in government. How do you keep going, recharge the batteries?
There's two big juggles I find in politics. One is the work-family balance, and the other is the thinking-doing balance. I'm getting better at the work-family balance, making my parliamentary colleague, Katie Gallagher, says if you can't attend an event in the evening or on the weekend because you need to be with your children, you shouldn't say sorry for that, because raising children is as much a part of what you ought to be doing as is attending community functions. So I've tried to be as careful as I can in how I use my time to make sure that I'm there for Gwyneth and the three little boys, as well as being in the community as much as I can. The thinking-doing balance is tougher. I'm still trying to get that right. To be honest, it's part of the reason, Richard, why I've continued to write books as a politician, because I find that through writing down my own ideas about a particular issue, I clarify what I actually think.
The thing about your electorate, just while I think of it, is that although it's, you know, you have all these people and you're not away, you're never away from it. That's the thing. But you also get to go home to the family every night, which most politicians don't.
Yes, that's right. That's sort of a little unusual for Australia. In the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, when parliamentarians become more senior, typically they move their families to the national capital and go back on weekends to campaign in their electorates. So they're at home with the family most nights. Australia doesn't have that mould. Paul Keating was atypical in moving his family to Canberra when he became treasurer, but I think it does create a little bit more of a disconnect between families and parliamentarians.
I want to go back to the beginning of your political career, because it's actually longer ago than most people realise. You were the the ALP sacrificial candidate, weren't you?
I was. I ran as the candidate for a seat called Northcote, which is around Pennant Hills, Beecroft, Cherrybrook, Hornsby, against Barry O'Farrell in his first run for New South Wales politics. We both got something we wanted. I got an 8% swing for the Labor Party, and Barry O'Farrell won the seat with a 24% margin. He continued after that to stay in touch when I had good fortune in my life. Often a handwritten congratulations note from Barry O'Farrell would arrive. And there's sort of a deep irony in the fact that it was those generous handwritten notes which ultimately were the source of his undoing.
It's interesting, that seat, which no longer exists, it's now been absorbed into other state seats. So essentially, you're saying, though, there is a moment of triumph in this, isn't there, for you? You converted it from an extraordinarily safe Liberal seat to just a very, very safe Liberal seat.
Nicely put.
So how long have you been a member of the Labor Party?
So I joined the Labor Party when I was 18. It was at Sydney University Orientation Week. There was a bloke called Luke Foley standing on the Sydney University Labor Club stand.
Now the leader of the New South Wales opposition.
Indeed. And he persuaded me I should not only join the Labor Club but also the Labor Party. My father had been in the Labor Party when he was younger. And it was something that I was pretty natural that I joined. I wanted to be part of progressive change, but also to be part of a party which was an alternative government.
But you're not a factional person. You're not in a faction. You're not a factional player. That's unusual, Andrew.
I'm not, but many around Australia in the Labor Party aren't. You look in Tasmania, people like Scott Bacon, the Shadow Treasurer in Western Australia, Mark McGowan, the state leader there, in the Federal Parliament, Alana McTiernan, the member for Perth, or Nova Peris, Senator from the Northern Territory. So there's the great thing about the modern Labor Party, Richard, is that it has space for people who are in the left faction, in the right faction, or not in any faction at all.
But won't it in the future, in a future Labor government, won't it constrain how senior you can become?
I've always felt that you should make decisions based foremost on principle and then worry later about what that does for your career. The fixed number of slots at the top in politics means that you can spend your entire political career fretting about where you are on the pecking order. A better approach is to wake up each morning and feel incredibly fortunate that you have the privilege of serving in Parliament. Only a bit over 1,000 people have served in the Federal Parliament since Federation. So to have that opportunity is incredibly exciting in itself. To be able to have the chance to help shape policies for a future Shorten government is great fun.
All right. Well, one thing I must ask before we wrap this up, AC/DC, because in the economics of just about everything, you write that economics has things to say about AC/DC. Now, the band's touring Australia in November. What's the connection?
So the aspect of AC/DC that I focus on, the economics of just about everything, is the notion that there's two kinds of innovators. There's innovators who have a big, grand idea. There's innovators who build on experience, Bob Dylan or Nick Cave, in terms of those who build in a whole lot of different ideas from different contexts and whose work grows better as they go on. AC/DC is quite the opposite. AC/DC is very much the Picasso of the music world. Best work done early on, big single ideas thrown onto the page quickly and then into the studio, cut the record and get it out for people. So I suspect that those looking to see AC/DC in their prime have unfortunately arrived a few decades too late.
Andrew Lee, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Lee is the MP for Fraser and the Shadow Assistant Treasurer. If you want to hear the interview again or find out more, head to the website. Just put Sunday Profile into Google, you'll find it. The program's produced by Mudita Dias. I'm Richard Ady.